Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus.
Many doubted we'd ever see it. But here it is. The return to glory.
For the fourth time, the United States of America are crowned champions of the world. And for the very first time, they've done it on European soil.
Now the Warriors just inbound, and that's it. There's a new NBA champion, and it's a team from Toronto, Canada.
In 2019, the world of sports had some all-time highs and more than a few all-time lows. On the field, the Patriots won another Super Bowl to cap an NFL season where much of the focus was on pregame protests. The Toronto Raptors won the NBA Finals for that franchise's first championship. Tiger Woods stunned the golf world by winning his fifth Masters at age 43 after a lost decade. The U.S. women's national team won its fourth FIFA World Cup as it continued fighting for equal pay. And the Washington Nationals won a seven-game fall classic over the Houston Astros, who were soon defending themselves against cheating allegations. Joining us to look back on the year that was is WAMC sports commentator Keith Strudler, director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. Keith, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here.
What stands out for you in the world of sports in 2019?
Boy, it's always remarkable when you hear all of the things that happened. So in some ways for me, I think one of the more interesting stories happened in the NBA with the Toronto Raptors' surprising championship and all the chaos that ensued afterwards. Just the massive shift that happened in the NBA balance of power, where everyone seemed like was a free agent. And, you know, you had the team that, you know, I suppose that was the dynasty of the NBA now is, I still believe, sitting somewhere around last place and has no real prospect for improvement. So I think the NBA, I think, and the volatility that came out of that is probably the most interesting. You could also make the argument that, you know, the continued dynasty of the New England Patriots and just this, you know, endless kind of search for when Tom Brady might show a sign of age, although he does appear to be getting ever so slightly older, at least when he's trying to scramble out of the pocket, which is happening more and more now. But I think that's, you know, also a pretty interesting story. You know, they're all great, but the NBA to me is the story of the year.
So you were just mentioning the Golden State Warriors, who let that finals get away against the Raptors and went from being virtually unbeatable overnight to very much human in the same time that LeBron James packed up and went west.
Absolutely. And so this is really, I guess we will know next year, and maybe next year we will be talking about whether LeBron James is still kind of the king of the NBA or whether that era has passed. Right now, obviously, it's looking fairly good for the Lakers. But one thing I think you can say about the NBA in its current incarnation is truly that it is now kind of a real story of the rich and the poor. And you're either a have or you're a have not. And you have, you know, an incredible balance of power in Houston. You've got two great teams in Los Angeles. And then you have some absolutely miserable franchises. And it seems like it doesn't take much to go from, you know, the top to the basement, like happened with Golden State. And you look at the Knicks as a team that just, you know, at some point they might win a game. I mean, it's a very strange time. But I think we will be able to put a little bit more context on LeBron's place in the pantheon of all-time greats probably after this year ends.
We'll get back to the Knicks in a minute. LeBron said something the other day that was very interesting. He was talking about this concept of load management. And I can sort of see both sides of this in the NBA. On the one hand, teams know that a game in December against the Knicks is not going to make or break their season. And so if their stars have a day to rest, it maybe makes sense to do it. On the other hand, as LeBron said, you know, he's coming to the end at some point in the next couple of years of his career. And he doesn't want someone to go to the game and not see him play.
I think there's probably, you could read that in about three or four or five different ways. I think there's a basic kind of core question that has to be asked when you look at this, which is the NBA entertainment commodity or is it a sporting event, right? Are people there because they want to win championships or are they there because they're trying to, you know, to make money off of a product? You know, if you think of it more like an entertainment commodity, like let's say professional wrestling. Well, look, if you're going to go to a professional wrestling match, you're going to want to see Hulk Hogan. I know I've really just dated myself. I understand that. But that's, you're going to want to see the stars come out to play. In many ways, I think the people that run the NBA, certainly Adam Silver's office, would like to remind everyone that this is an entertainment property. On the other hand, as Greg Popovich made very clear, you know, a few years ago, you can't do it. Not with the you know, you can't win all the time if you're playing all the time when you have stars who are aging. I think the interesting thing with LeBron is, you know, I'm sure LeBron would want some days off, but in many ways, it almost seems as if LeBron is thinking more about his life after basketball than his current life in it. Because what would be better for LeBron to continue to grow his brand than to make sure every city he goes, he's kind of the most popular guy there and everyone's talking about him. So, you know, for LeBron, I truly believe he probably cares deeply about his fans. But I think in many ways, this is kind of the beginning of the next chapter for him.
Okay, now let's talk about the Knicks. And no, this is not a rerun of last year's segment where I asked you, hey, Keith, what's going on with the Knicks? Last time we did one of these, they had a new coach coming in, David Fizdale, maybe the idea of turning things around. Now, end of 2019, Fizdale's gone.
Sure. So, by the way, that worked out really poorly for the Knicks. So it doesn't seem like that was the right hire. Now, to be fair, he may not have had enough time to turn it around. So the Knicks are kind of like the Titanic. Like, you don't, you got to steer it slowly from behind. So, I'm going to be quite honest. If you think I've watched more than about 12 minutes of Knicks basketball this year, you should take the under on that. And we are kind of, usually this is about the time of the year, once we get through the college football championships, that's when I start to shift into it's NBA time of the year, because it seems like the players start to care a little bit more. But it's, look, with everything that happened with Brooklyn, with KD deciding that you can be in New York and live in an outer borough is just fine. I don't see a great pathway forward for the Knicks. And at least in this current ownership structure, it seems very clear that athletes do not want to come and play for the Knicks organization and pay whatever kind of exorbitant New York City tax on top of that. There's just no seeming benefit. And I guess, look, you could make the argument it's not even the taxes, because people are going to L.A. So and they go to Canada, higher taxes there. So at some point, it seems to have to come back to the same thing over and over again. The only constant with the Knicks over the past several years has been the ownership. So, you know, I don't see that changing anytime soon. So I'm guessing if you're a Knicks fan, I apologize. Too bad. It just is what it is.
Same old story for sure. Let's stay in winter sports. Not long ago, you had a chance to interview the commissioner of the NHL, Gary Bettman. Tell us about that.
It's fantastic. Look, the real play for me, the commissioner lives a town over from me, and so I was hoping this was going to be parlayed into, hey, why don't you come to our Super Bowl party, tickets to the Garden. So that's really the long-term play. It hasn't happened yet. We're working on it. What was most interesting about the conversation with the commissioner was the shift that the NHL has undergone in the past, 10, 15 years. If you went back far enough into the early 2000s, the NHL seemed like a sports property that was really kind of the odd man out. They were too small. Their audience was too niche. They were having a hard time connecting with the TV audience, right? And all the things that made the NFL what the NFL was, which is they really thrived in this massive broadcast space where, you know, even casual fans could pay attention. If you fast forward to today, the name of the game isn't necessarily the size of your audience, but the fervor and the interest, right? And how kind of clingy they are to your product. Well, no one has more kind of intense and deeply ingrained fans than the NHL. So in some ways, the NHL is kind of the right-sized sports league. And the way that they're kind of looking at the fact that, you know, their fans, their NHL fans are going to be fans for life. You know, the kind of issues that are making it challenging for the NFL, whether it's concussions or things like that, you know, in many ways, it hasn't really even taken a kink of the armor for the NHL. So I think that's one of the first takeaways. I think the second takeaway that I found very interesting was the NHL's increased interest in ensuring a highly technological spectator experience. And that has to do with the way that they're bringing biometric data to their fans, the way that they understand themselves as kind of a technology company, the way that they're focused on second screen experiences. I think that's, you know, was a pretty interesting takeaway. And the third, you know, I think one of the people in the audience asked a little bit about fighting, and it was interesting to hear the commissioner's perspective, which is they think they have a really good product, you know. And this was kind of one of my old grievances with hockey, which was, you know, in pro hockey, it was I felt like that cheapened the experience. Obviously, there's a lot less of it now, and we really don't have the kind of, you know, the players that were brought there just to kind of be enforcers. You see a whole lot less of that. But the commissioner's theory is, hey, these things work out. There's a reason it's still in the league, and it's kind of self-enforcing. So I guess the last thing I would say is we did talk to the commissioner a little bit about their perspective on how they would deal with growth in China. And look, the NHL doesn't have the kind of footprint that the NBA has in China, for sure. And they certainly don't have the longevity. And basketball has been in China for quite some time, starting with the shoe companies and the athletes themselves. So, you know, they have a much bigger kind of, you know, risk reward proposition with what's happened with the NBA in China. But I asked the commissioner, obviously the commissioner won't comment on what he thinks the NBA should do. But when I asked him how he would counsel his players, his owners, you know, his GMs and so forth about what they can or shouldn't say about other countries, about China. And he simply said that he would not be in the business of telling his people what to say. And if China had issues with, you know, some of the things that you know, some of the people in the league said, you know, that would be an issue that they would deal with. But he wasn't going to start censoring or changing the ethos of the NHL. So I think in some ways they're much more cautious about that expansion.
We're speaking with Keith Strudler, the WAMC sports commentator and director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. You've actually taken me to this next place, and that is London. I want to talk about leagues looking to play more games in that part of the world. We saw the Yankees and the Red Sox have a two-game series in London. Recently, some college matchups were announced for London. There's the possibility of the NFL returning year in and year out. Why are teams so anxious and leagues so anxious to penetrate that market?
It's like anything. There's only so much growth that you can have in the United States. And I think in many ways, you know, we're kind of at our limit, particularly given the amount of entertainment properties and commodities that are available to the general public. So, I mean, look, if you go home any evening, you're going to turn on whatever streaming device you have, and there's going to be 100,000,000 shows on. Only some of them are going to be sports, and particularly given the kind of the challenges for live television and the cable industry right now, you know, there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to make more money in the U.S. I suppose to some degree, London and European markets offer you additional chances to make money and to build your brand, and certainly for the athletes to, you know, kind of sell themselves as brands. The only thing I would say about London, it's a good idea. You want to play some games over there. You want to build your fans over there and so forth. You know, a lot of them, and certainly the NHL had this perspective, there's really not a whole lot of money for them over in Europe, even though they play there all the time, right? They want to see the highest level of hockey. All that stuff's kind of good. But they have existing leagues. Like, they're never going to be able to really break in. While I think it's really smart and necessary for, you know, whether it's the NBA, certainly the NFL, the NHL, to play games in Europe, I think at some point, if they're going to have to figure out their Chinese and Asian strategy for making money, because those are the untapped markets where there aren't existing sports leagues, where they aren't existing kind of bureaucratic structures in place that make it hard for them to make money, where they can build stadiums from scratch. I mean, that's the other, you know, I guess London's a little bit more enviable because it's one of the few places they have in England, they have kind of American style professional football sports stadiums. A lot of these countries just don't even have the facilities to house kind of a profitable American sports league kind of property. So the other thing, you know, you'll hear from most people is really no one seems to be talking at all about putting a team over there full time. Certainly we asked the commissioner about that. I mean, you've seen that from the NFL for sure. You know, the NBA seems disinterested in that. No one seems to want to put a team or even a cluster of teams over there full time. Maybe it's because they don't have the ownership in place. But for whatever it's worth, I think whatever happens over in Europe will always be relatively limited. And they'll get a taste of these games, but they're not going to get, you know, kind of a full structure.
Let me name some names and you tell me what they have in common, okay?
Is there a prize at the end of this? Fingers crossed.
You mentioned a couple of them. So we've got Tom Brady. We've got Megan Rapinoe. We've got Roger Federer. We've got Rafa Nadal, Novak Djokovic. I'll throw LeBron in there.
All over the age of 35?
Exactly. They're old.
And oh!
Doesn't it seem like we're sort of at the end of an era?
It absolutely does. It does seem like, well, look, a couple things are happening. And one is, I think, and this has started to happen several years ago, players realize they can stretch their careers further. And whether that's medical science, whether that's because it's worth playing through it because there's so much money. You know, at some point it was just wasn't worth playing any longer because you weren't making that much and you were in a lot of pain. Now it's kind of worth staying in the game a little bit longer. I mean, it's hard, you know, if Tom Brady can still run and throw, you know, it's tough to turn down $30 million a year to do that. So I think we'll see a lot more players stretching out their careers a lot longer, although football will be the interesting kind of potential outlier in that. But yeah, in tennis, for sure, it does feel as if this is all kind of coming to an end. Although, let's be clear, I think we all said that like 5 years ago. I think every time you saw Roger Federer play in a major 5 years ago, you're like, this could be the last time. And he seems exactly the same now as he was then.
So, and you know, Keith, I was remiss there in not mentioning the Williamses, but they show no signs of slowing down, really.
Serena's still the best tennis player in the world. I mean, and so until someone is better than her, and Serena has, you want to talk about, like we were talking about with basketball, about kind of load management. No one has done a better job with load management than Serena Williams. I think she never felt that she had to win every tournament or play the kind of, for lack of a better word, the kind of the garbage tour. Like, she knew what she wanted to do. In many ways, she was kind of like Lance Armstrong, although obviously, you know, leave out the places where you would not want that comparison. But she was like Lance, and Lance wanted to win the Tour de France. Like, Lance didn't want to win every single Grand Tour and all these other races. He wanted to win the one or two races that really mattered. Serena has done the exact same thing, and she shows up big for the events that matter. And I think that's allowed her to stay healthier and to stay more, you know, to stay hungry and stay more competitive. So it'll be interesting to see. Again, someone like Serena will have lots and lots of opportunities in popular culture to do probably whatever she wants, whether that's in acting or entertainment or whatever. So we'll see how long that continues to go on. But I think on the men's side, you know, it really seems like Nadal, Federer, like, they just like playing, right? I mean, it's, you know, so who knows?
I want to end on kind of a sad note. You know, one of my favorite websites, Deadspin, closed down effectively this year. The site's still up, but all the people walked out en masse after the editor was told basically stick to sports. And it reminded me of you because one thing you do for us here on WAMC is look at sports through a different lens from the point of view of what it means in society. And that was precisely what Deadspin was told not to do at a time where obviously the protests over the NFL, have been subject of widespread debate. And, you know, you had the Harvard and Yale game shut down by protesters for an hour and a half or something like that. So what do you think, you know, the future holds in 2020 in an election year for this intersection of sports and politics and our culture?
So I'll say a few things to that. So I will probably give you more answer than you want. But first, I think kind of the general kind of macro question is, I expect that there will be more and more people talking about that intersectionality between sport and larger social issues. And I think, you know, that's a trend that's not going to go away, particularly as we get into some of the larger international sporting events, whether as we get into the Olympics. I think this is going to be a place where we are negotiating everything from race, gender, socioeconomics, international political events. I think people are comfortable talking about that intersection of sport and social issues, although obviously not everyone. Now, in terms of what we do here at WAMC, big plug for public radio. I mean, this is why we exist, because we are not beholden to certain corporate interests. So it's really important that there's a space where you can have those frank conversations that are not, you know, necessarily focus on the exact bottom line. In terms of the deadspin issue, though, because I have some kind of a pretty strong opinion on the deadspin thing. Certainly, I'm sad to see this go the way it went. My only kind of qualm on this, because everyone at Deadspin, and with all due respect to all the journalists that work there, kind of threw their arms up as if they had been, as if they somehow had been trying to save the world for the last 20 years. The reality is Deadspin kind of made its way with a whole lot of snark and a lot of inappropriate content and stuff that I thought was kind of not just kind of outside the boundaries of sport or the intersectionality of sport and social issue, but was kind of out of bounds. And I thought it was kind of mean-spirited a lot of the time. And so when all of a sudden they had a boss that wanted to make money and they didn't think they were going to be able to make money the way they wanted to make money, then they all of a sudden started to talk about, we care so deeply about about journalism and about its tradition and history and all the important work that we do. And they've broken a lot of good stories, and I don't take that away from them. But it sometimes rings a little hollow coming from Deadspin, I suppose, because I don't think they always kind of adhered to that, that ethos. I mean, they're not the Washington Post. And so I think in some ways it was the lady doth protest too much.
Not to interrupt you, but I teach the Gawker case in my ethics class, and you're absolutely right. So for living on the edge the way those sites did, it's fun while you're in the ride and breaking stories and pushing the boundaries and so on. But what they've, I think, learned is that if you operate without regard to what's in good taste and what isn't, you don't have a lot of allies left when you yourself become the story.
Absolutely. I think that is exactly right. And so, it's a lesson for a lot of media organizations. And I do think, it'll be interesting to see what happens with some other sports sites, whether it's The Athletic, which I think a lot of us are still trying to figure out how that works. And there's going to be a big shift in the sports media space over the next decade as some of the traditional powers become different and change their business models. I mean, look, a lot of people are paying attention to what's happening at Sports Illustrated right now. Who knows what kind of power the leagues themselves and the teams will exert in terms of overseeing and distributing content. And that would obviously change the nature of what people say and what gets covered. So, not to get on a soapbox here, but I think people do need to kind of continue to fight the good fight and talk about the things that matter while still recognizing that it's a business and in some regard, it's a game.
Keith, is there anything that I forgot to ask you about or you wanted to add to this?
Well, I think we forgot to talk about the remarkable rise of University of Florida football this year, really a stone's throw away from the national championship. They have lost two games this year to the, I believe, number one and number five team in the country. So I think that's something, that's probably the number one story of the year. And also, I think, if you were to ask me what was the biggest moment of the year in sports, we'd go back to the Saturday after Thanksgiving when Cornell hockey laid a hurting on Boston University, the dreaded Terriers, and kind of established themselves as king of the garden once again. And are en route to probably a national title. And so I think those two moments are probably what most of the listeners remember as kind of these truly historic, memorable magazine cover moments of the year.
Let me add one more. I don't know if you could ever top it for dramatics, but the Virginia-Purdue game in the NCAA tournament, it's not quite rising to the level of Cornell hockey, but that was something.
It was. Look, NCAA tournament's always great. And it's hard not to be a big fan of Virginia basketball just because of all the struggles and all the challenges and so forth. It's hard for me to ever think in advance I can't wait to watch a Purdue-Virginia basketball game because I assume it's going to be, the winner's going to have about 12 points. So, but yes, they, as always, and I expect this year the tournament to be the highlight of the year. Although one of my teams seems to be doing well, the other not so much.
We've been speaking with Keith Strudler, the WAMC sports commentator and director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. And love having this year-end wrap-up tradition with you, Keith, and keep watching the games.
Absolutely. Thanks, and Happy New Year to everyone.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Two-point game. Jerome, short, back tap, Diakite. a race for it. Into the hands of Clark. Got a chance to win it here. Up the front is Diakite for the win. And it goes!